Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 241 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man some call the third member of pioneering electronic band Kraftwerk, Chris Roche. Hey, Chris.
Robin, that was slightly eccentric.
I'm impressed that it's only slightly eccentric. It's, I suppose, a compliment of sorts.
Have you ever actually listened to any Kraftwerk? It's quite strange. It was not my era. It was my brother's era, and I remember him playing it. Never a huge fan, but they have a following, apparently.
I'm surprised you're not a big fan, seeing how you're a founding member. Today we're going to talk about the German Grand Prix from Hockenheim, which was the 11th round of the Formula One Championship, and then I'm going to give a brief rundown of the IndyCar race that happened in Toronto a little over a week ago. For full schedules of all four series, go to funwithcars.com/schedules. By the way, it is Tuesday evening, July 24th, and here are the results from the German Grand Prix. It was Lewis Hamilton who won the race for Mercedes. Valtteri Bottas, his teammate, was right behind him in second place. Third place went to the one and only finishing Ferrari of Kimi Raikkonen. And fourth place was the lead Red Bull of Max Verstappen. Fifth place, Nico Hülkenberg and the Renault. Strong result for them. And sixth place went to Romain Grosjean and the Haas Ferrari. He finished and in the points. Seventh place, Sergio Perez in the Force India, the lead Force India, just ahead of Esteban Ocon in the second Force India in eighth. Marcus Ericsson finished ninth in the Sauber Ferrari, the lead Sauber Ferrari. And Brendan Hartley, we don't get to say this very often, the lead Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda, scoring a point in 10th. 11th place with the second Haas of Kevin Magnussen, and 12th place, Carlos Sainz in the second Renault. 13th place, the leading McLaren, Stoffel Van Dorn. 14th place, the second Toro Rosso Honda of Pierre Gasly. 15th place, Charles Leclerc. 16th place, Fernando Alonso in the second McLaren. 17th place, and not classified as a finish, 17th through 20th, and that was led by Lance Stroll, Sebastian Vettel, Sergei Sirokin, and Daniel Ricciardo. So, Chris, what do you think?
I think it's a really fascinating F1 season, and you can't predict what on earth is going to happen. Just when you think one driver's got the upper hand, the tables are turned. Fascinating. Fascinating. I mean, Saturday night looked really bleak for Hamilton and his legion of fans, and that he only qualified 14th. Vettel was on pole, 8 points behind in the championship, having had to come from behind at Silverstone. Looked like it was going to be a tough one. And Vettel was finally going to get his win at his home track in Hockenheim. And it all turned around during the race.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. For me, I'm pretty convinced that hell has frozen over. We have the political world that we have. And in addition to that, Sebastian Vettel won the British Grand Prix and Lewis Hamilton's won the German Grand Prix. I'm sorry, that's backwards. Something is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Vettel, Ferrari have been so strong, and they at the last couple of Grand Prix, Vettel was on pole by, what, over 2/10? Looked like it was going to be a stroll in the park. Of course, the rain was a factor, and some bizarre tactics by Ferrari to pit Raikkonen early and then hold his teammate up through the middle portion of the race, I don't think really helped them. But ultimately, it came down to a mistake by Vettel. I mean, in the lead, comfortably in the lead. I mean, obviously, the conditions by the time he binned it were tricky. The track was wet. He was on slicks, but he got it wrong in going into the Sachs curve, locked the rear axle, and ended up in the wall.
I have to say, I'm pretty impressed that you've managed to be as diplomatic as you have been. I mean, I was expecting basically the audio equivalent of you having the Union Jack wrapped around your shoulders and just belting out God Save the Queen. I'm pretty impressed that you've shown such restraint, because this was a pretty devastating moment for Sebastian Vettel.
Oh, I didn't notice on his home track with 100,000 Germans. Was it devastating, you think?
Yeah, you did. I mean, this is the type of, this is why I'm here, to give you the detail, the nuanced analysis. He was visibly, audibly very upset from it. And I think that it's worth mentioning just how nuts and crazy this German Grand Prix was. If every race were like the German Grand Prix, you'd have twice the audience. I mean, it was nuts how much passing and strategy differentiation and weather conditions, everything. I mean, it was just a brilliant race. And I don't know what it is. You know, Sebastian Vettel is a brilliant driver, and he just had the briefest momentary lapse of judgment. And it didn't even turn into a big off. I don't think, had that been a paved runoff, I don't think the car would have even been much damaged. But it just was in a way that he managed to beach it that really just kind of ended the race for him. Not only did that open up the race for Hamilton, completely opens up the Drivers' Championship, the Constructors' Championship, everything. I mean, this was a big, big deal.
Yeah, I mean, the question for me was whether or not Vettel was starting to feel under pressure, because, I mean, if we recap a little bit, Hamilton had done a good job to get up from 14th to 5th pretty quickly without burning up his soft compound tyres. That allowed him to run through to lap 42, I believe.
Yeah, that's right, 42.
Before he was able to change to the quicker tyre. So he was running the tyres in the reverse order as everyone else. Everyone else, all the top runners, started on the ultra softs and then switched off of those at their pit stops, whereas Hamilton was able to switch to the faster tyre at his pit stop. And of course, that happened just before the rain started to come down. So he's on fresh rubber, the quickest compound, the softest compound. And that for sure was an advantage for him. But he was, after his pit stop, over 20 seconds behind Vettel. But he was absolutely pulling that gap down hand over fist, as much as 3 seconds on a couple of laps. You know, and he got it down to sort of, I think, around 11, 12 seconds when the rain started coming down. And you kind of wonder if Vettel was trying to respond to that. But he didn't really need to, and it wasn't a big mistake. So maybe I'm reading too much into that. But certainly that's, you know, I had a good feeling at that point of the race that Hamilton was certainly going to get on the podium through, you know, even if there hadn't been a safety car period, and was going to maybe even fight for the win at that point. And then, you know, Vettel cracked and Hamilton inherited the lead when Bottas and Raikkonen pitted. So, and then he was able to hold Bottas off. I was surprised that Mercedes even allowed a one-lap contest between Bottas and Hamilton at the restart. But they soon put that sort of shenanigans and told Bottas to stay put, which I agree with. And it quickly followed the team orders that Ferrari had applied to get Vettel to pass Raikkonen, which was amusing in itself. We could talk about that incident, I think, at some length if you want to. But the fact that Raikkonen wasn't going to take
Raikkonen
any coded signals.
Hero. That's all there is to say about that.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to hear your opinion on Lewis Hamilton's post-race interview with David Coulthard. And I also want to hear your opinion about his hairstyle during the post-race interview. Let's cut right to the chase here.
So he came in for a lot of stick, didn't he, after quali? And people were reading a lot into his body language when he was kneeling by the car. I mean, he tried to push the car back to the pit lane, which was never going to work. There was a third of a lap to go. And, you know, he was quite distraught when he had to pull over, and he spent some time kneeling by the side of the car. And, you know, your good body, the man who should never have been world champion but somehow fluked it, Nico Rosberg, was really laying in. You know, the guy is already down, and Nico's piling it on, saying, you know, I've never seen body language like that from Lewis, and this could be a bad sign.
And he was quick to point out, oh, this was Lewis Hamilton's mistake. Look, he overdrove here, and he hit these two big bumps here.
That's right. And so I think Lewis, I don't know if it was specifically to Nico, but maybe some of the criticism he'd come in for post-quali, you know, he was like, if you don't know me, this is who I am. Like, you know, a complete fighter, someone who, you know, it was a scintillating drive by him, almost wheel perfect, apart from the pit stop shenanigans, which wasn't really his fault. It was his team giving him mixed instructions. It was a superb recovery drive, just like he'd done at Silverstone. And so
yes. But like Chris, we've covered that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about his hair. you're completely burying the lead here.
His hair, I think, I'd probably got stuck to him. It was someone else's hair that was inside his own crash helmet and got came off with the balaclava. Yeah, it was weird. I'm not going to go into that. But, you know, if you're that successful and you've just signed a £40 million a year contract, you could probably get away with whatever hairstyle you want.
It seemed like a variation of cornrows, which is a hairstyle that I've seen plenty of here in the States. But I was really, when he took his helmet off, I was really surprised at that. And his hair, I have to admit, did seem a fair amount longer than I've seen it, even in the recent past. So I don't know what happened there or how.
I think it's called hair extensions, mate. And again, you know, if you're as successful and
hair
as talented as him, you can get away with it. I can't.
That's okay. Color me surprised. I'll say that. And I will, let me repeat one more time. Lewis drove brilliantly. And his attitude, in many ways, was correct. But I was surprised at how overtly religious he got during the podium interview. You know, a little bit, you'll forgive me for this, a little bit self-righteous with this, if you don't know me, now you do, kind of talk. To me, that seemed a little bit much and a little bit in your face. It's like, you're a 4-times world champion. No one thinks poorly of you on track. Do you see what I'm getting at here? It's like he's trying to prove to people that he's worthy. And it's like, everyone knows you're worthy already. Thanking God is great. Seriously, nothing wrong with that. But I was just very surprised with how overt and grandiose he made that.
Yeah, he's an emotional guy, isn't he? And I was fascinated by one of the Sky interviews before the Brit Grand Prix, where he was being interviewed by Jenson Button, and he was being pretty candid about how tough he was finding the championship, how much he was having to fight, you know, how close it was between the Ferrari and Mercedes. And, you know, clearly he wants this one really badly, and it is obviously a tough battle out there. It's very close. And, you know, he's always, I don't think his relationship with God is anything new, right? He's mentioned numerous times that he prays before the races. I mean, and his hero, Ayrton Senna, was a very religious man who used to believe in divine intervention when he was thrashing Prost from time to time. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with that. He got booed in Germany, which was a bit shocking, and he alluded to that as well. So I think he just, obviously the adrenaline was still flowing, and he felt the need to come out with a few statements, but it wasn't that inflammatory, was it?
No, I wouldn't call it inflammatory, and I'm not trying to suggest that. It was just, it was definitely, I'll say this, it was actually quite enjoyable and endearing to see as much personality as we did. It was just a little bit surprising exactly what that personality was that he was showing. That's all. There's no intention of judgment here other than the fact that it surprised me. Not diminished by the hairstyle, I should add one more time. But you're absolutely right, Chris. We should talk about how Scuderia Toro Rosso outperformed McLaren. That is a really good point. I found it fascinating that it wasn't Gasly that was leading. It was, in fact,
dude, you got to get a grip. There was so much action going at the front, and you're worried about whether Honda are going to scrape another point. I mean, really?
Well, you're right. That's a good point to make, Chris. Honda did score a point, and McLaren didn't. If I'm looking at one point for 10th, yep. And let's see, the lead McLaren in 13th and 16th. Yeah, see, no points there.
Well, that's a very good observation. Well made. Let's move on to something more interesting, shall we? Would you, at this point, let's see, one of the STRs started at the back because he took an engine penalty, is that correct? Because he, you know, the engine had lasted more than 3 laps, so they had to rebuild it. Is that correct?
Yeah,
I think Pierre Gasly started at the back with Daniel, didn't he? So it is an interesting contest. I think it's not STR versus McLaren so much as Honda versus Renault as to who could still build the most unreliable F1 engine. I think that's really where the contest is at.
It does seem that and way.
And Red Bull find themselves in this situation where, I mean, poor Daniel Ricciardo, right? He already is facing, starting at the back of the field, and he still blows up. He's got a brand new motor, and it doesn't even last halfway through the race.
That's the scary bit. That was new stuff.
Yeah.
That's the properly scary bit.
Yeah, that's poor. But I hate to tell Red Bull, but it's going to be just as bad next year once they get the Hondas in the back of their car. So,
but let's talk about this a little bit though, because Nico Hülkenberg, he finished fifth, and he's got Renault power clearly.
Well, factory Renault though.
But it's an interesting question, though, right? I mean, the factory Renault team has not suffered some inordinate amount of engine failures. You know, Carlos has been underperforming a little bit as of late, and it happened here again. Big difference, fifth place for Nico versus 12th for Carlos Sainz. But I feel like there's woes at Red Bull and McLaren that aren't fully explained by the Renault power unit. Or are they? I mean, is it just the factory make sure they have the best stuff and it's as simple as that?
Well, I mean, going back a couple of seasons when Nico did fluke his championship, I mean, we talked about this, I think, you know, all the failures with the Mercedes engine and car that year happened on Lewis's chassis. Nico hardly had any reliability issues, and nor did any of the Mercedes runners. So sometimes weird things happen where the unreliability occurs to the same driver or same team consistently, even though they're using the same equipment.
Yeah,
I got to believe that Renault is providing equal powertrains to all their teams. But you start to wonder after a while, don't you? But I thought Red Bull had a weak weekend, actually. I mean, so obviously Daniel had his problems, but he didn't exactly zip through the field from last place, did he, compared to certainly Lewis's speed through the back order. But then you had them completely rolling the dice to put Verstappen on Inters when clearly it wasn't Inter weather. Now, I do applaud them because they're always looking for the alternate strategy to try and give themselves a shot of winning a race. But that one seemed a bit of a stretch. And of course, you had to come back in and get slicks on not long after that. And it was only because they have such a pace advantage over the rest of the field that he was still able to salvage a fourth place. But Red Bull certainly seemed quite happy to just go left field at the first opportunity to try and get an advantage.
First, I want to make a quick correction. Nico Rosberg won the championship.
Did he?
And Jacques Villeneuve fluked the championship. And we can get into that at a later date. Yeah, the alternative strategy, it's not an alternative and risky strategy if it always works. You know, it's somehow clairvoyant and ordained if Red Bull kept getting it right. But I think one thing that is fair to point out is that the weather was truly unpredictable. And it was just cruel irony for German and Dutch fans that it was after the checkered flag, just by a minute or two, that true rain dumped on the track. What was threatening just kind of skimmed at the surface, and Inters were only barely justified maybe for a lap or two and proved to not be worth it at all. Just as you say, Red Bull gambled and gambled incorrectly. And I think part of why Hamilton performed as well as he did, you know, it was his core strategies, like go out on the soft tire, which is a fairly hard tire, and just stretch it out as long as you can. And he did that. And that certainly required a lot of skill to keep the tires alive for 42 laps.
Well, but his pace was good at the end of that stint as well, right? He was keeping in touch with the Ferraris on fresher rubber. So
exactly right. And he did that. And when he came in for the pit stop, that was when the weather really started getting questionable and different reports were coming in from close by about heavy rain. And it just always skimmed the surface and never truly affected Hamilton. And because Hamilton had a softer tire that he could lean on just a little bit more and get temperature in just a little bit quicker, he could manage slightly damp turns here and there better than a lot of his competitors. that probably provoked some of the nerves that made Sebastian push a little bit harder than he should have, which ended up putting him in the wall.
It was weird conditions because Hockenheim, you know, I remember Hockenheim back in its glory days when it was a proper racetrack. And you used to blast off from the stadium section into the woods, right? And they had some really high-speed sections with some pretty daunting chicanes mixing it up. And it used to be a really different track to everybody, all the other modern tracks back in the day, so 90s, 80s. You know, you would expect that you might see different weather conditions at different parts of the track when it was a long, elongated circuit, as it used to be in the old days of Nürburgring, a 13-mile track, right, where it used to frequently rain in one part of the track and not in others. But this thing is emasculated and it's tiny now, and yet somehow we still had rain on one corner and not any of the others. It was really odd. And then, you know, no sooner had we had it, you know, dry up on one corner, it started raining on another corner. So it just, I mean, it kept them on their toes for at least, 10, 15 laps. And, you know, you could see who could deal with it and some who couldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you brought it up. Let's talk about it a little bit. You know, Kimi Räikkönen, just an absolute gem amongst personalities. And it's just, he's got this, like, anti-personality, which is so great to see. And I described him in the last podcast when I was alone. He's Mother Nature. He is not at all concerned about what it could be. He just sees what it is and deals with the situation at hand unemotionally. And here it was again, you know, with that radio exchange. He's like, do you want me to let Vettel by or not?
But don't you think it's a function of the fact that it's been widely reported that he's going to lose his seat at the end of the season? So I think he's sort of decided, well, whatever, I'll just be myself and play it straight. I'll play the team rules, but it's going to be transparent exactly what they are. I mean, which I think is perfectly reasonable and, you know, good that he's standing up for himself. But I think if he was looking for a seat in a Ferrari next year, he'd probably be a bit more diplomatic than that.
Yeah, that's possible. But, you know, he's going to be 39 in October. And
ooh, that's ancient.
Isn't it, though? And and, you know, there's still a lot of people that want him to stay at Ferrari. And he's the oldest driver on the grid by a pretty comfortable margin now, at least a year. And I think he's had a very long career. And I think unless he's made some desperately poor decisions, he's built up a pretty comfortable piggy bank to live off on after his racing career in Formula One. So I don't know. I don't think he's that concerned about whether Ferrari dumps him or not. I think, again, this goes back to his personality of, like, if they do, then that's what happens. And if they don't, then I'll keep racing. He seems so matter of fact that I have a hard time him expressing emotion in any way, be it snarkiness on the radio or otherwise.
So what fascinated me was, obviously, we had some driver signings over the weekend. Hamilton signed a 2-year deal with Mercedes, and then Bottas was signed on a 1-year deal. And so,
well,
the
hold on,
moved.
That's a 1-year deal with the option, with a second option.
That's right. Yeah.
And that option, maybe you know better than my, is that option on Bottas's side or on Mercedes' side?
I believe it's on Mercedes' side.
I'd be shocked if it wasn't, but the way it was described over broadcast, it was a bit fuzzy.
What I read was that Hamilton's deal is only for 2 years because Mercedes' deal to run in Formula One only extends for another 2 years. So therefore, they wouldn't sign a driver for longer than that. Because there's going to be a big, big renegotiation of the whole F1 deal with the teams, right? So we're not going to get into that. But what amazed me was the team that you keep alluding to as being hugely underperforming, which is true. I mean, McLaren suddenly seemed to have a whole plethora of drivers beating down their door to get in one of their cars. So, you know, they got Van Dorn and Alonso. Alonso may or may not re-sign, and obviously if he wants to stay around, McLaren would keep a seat open for him. But now they're talking about Lando Norris promoting him, or maybe offering a seat to Kimi Räikkönen, or maybe any other number of drivers that seem curiously attracted to the slow orange vehicle that's quite a hazard from time to time. Everyone wants to bail out of Williams, that's clear. Stroll is taking his Canadian dollars and moving on, which is terrible for Williams, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, everyone fancies the McLaren, and they seem quite similarly paced at the moment from where I'm sitting anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. McLaren's trajectory is maybe the same path, but they're not as far down that trajectory. And so I think it's easier to give
Williams
McLaren. See,
Williams the bottom. Yeah, of course, sorry.
Yeah, no, exactly right. The Williams has hit rock bottom and seems to be floundering around. However,
I think they're coming back. I think we saw the first signs.
Well, that's just it. This has given Paddy Lowe, I have granted him another Grand Prix of patience, because they did something. They adjusted the front wing, and it was not strictly for performance. It was just to add predictability to the best extent that they could try to add predictability. And by just the ever slightest of data that we have, it seems that it did work some. Although it was fascinating to me that Sergei Sorokin outqualified Lance Stroll, and Sorokin had the old setup and Stroll had the new setup.
Well, yeah. There you go. That's all we need to know about those two, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And the fact, I mean, they both ended up not finishing the race. So it became a result that didn't represent any progress. But it seems like, based on driver feedback, that there was some improvement. But then, just as you mentioned, Lance Stroll's father, as I understand, has been tied to potentially buying Force India.
Oh, really? Buying the whole team? Wow, there you go.
I heard that from someone else reading a headline, so please don't quote me as fact, but that's what I heard, yes.
He'll look great in the pink livery, I predict.
That's so lovely for you to predict.
Well, obviously Force India has been for sale for some time, isn't it? But I think it's one thing, sponsoring your son to get to Formula One, quite another to become an F1 team owner. So, interesting.
So this is from Planet F1, and it says, Lawrence Stroll set to buy Force India. And according to Germany's Automotor und Sport, Force India are holding the key to the midfield driver market as future, blah, blah, blah. And that, Stroll's investment in Force India proved to be true. His son is expected to make the move from Williams.
So do you think he would then get to veto who this teammate is, isn't he? So who would he take?
I would assume so. I mean, when you're the child of an extremely wealthy individual, I think you more or less get to pick whatever you want, whenever you want. And I would assume that includes F1 teammate.
So, I mean, both Ocon and Perez would handily dispatch Stroll, I would suggest, based on his current form. He has shown, the odd glimpse of promise, like the Italian Grand Prix a year or two ago when he was scintillating in the wet qualifying. But then he has weekends where he's just completely at sea, isn't he? He's just nowhere near the pace.
Yeah, he couldn't be bothered, And I think it's that ultimate effort that you have to put in to really push to be the best that I don't think Stroll would be the type of person to put in that effort. I don't know, but that's just in my limited experience. That's what I've noticed.
Seems to be a trend amongst recent Canadian F1 drivers then, doesn't it?
So tell me, what were the surprises of the German Grand Prix? I mean, really, in many ways, the whole thing was a surprise. But were there any surprise performances? You came in and you said, oh, wow, I didn't expect that.
Lewis Hamilton coming from 14th to win the race.
Oh, God. Aside from the second coming, who... other than Lewis Hamilton. I should have stipulated that from the beginning.
did I mention that was a surprise? I have to say, I was thoroughly engrossed in the battle for the lead. Wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to what was going on in the midfield. The midfield battle does itself look quite intriguing. I mean, the as you mentioned, the Renault, Force India... has been very quick. I mean, then locking out the third row of the grid was a surprise, honestly. Although,
Romain Grosjean finishing the race.
Well, that's another surprise.
Yeah, sixth place, points and a finish.
It's a great battle, and you get, Leclerc is somehow finding pace from the Sauber Alfa Romeo that no one ever thought would ever happen, and is always in the mix. So, yeah, it's a good midfield battle, and it's hard to predict who's really going to come out on top of that one, because Force India occasionally show, you know, the sort of form that won them fourth place in the championship last year, and then occasionally sort of drop off the radar. So their car seems to be very circuit dependent.
You mentioned the midfield, and it is exceedingly close up there. You know, Mercedes has retaken the lead in the Constructors' Championship with 310 points, but they're only 8 points ahead of Ferrari with 302. Third place, Red Bull, 211. That's a far cry behind the top two, but still well ahead of fourth place, Renault, with 80 points. But here's where it gets incredibly interesting. Fifth, sixth, and seventh, they're separated by 11 points, and fifth and sixth place are tied with 59 points, and fifth is Force India, sixth is Haas Ferrari. So if Haas keeps up this trend, them overtaking Force India is highly likely, and that puts Haas Ferrari in fifth in the constructors, which is a pretty darn impressive feat just from the newness of the team. And then it's also kind of a sad state of affairs for Force India, who finished fourth in the Constructors' Championship last year. So that's fascinating to see. Then we have McLaren in seventh place with 48 points. Based on trajectory, I don't think they're going to be a threat for fifth necessarily. Eighth place is a pretty decent drop back to Scuderia Toro Rosso with 20 points. Ninth, Sauber Ferrari with 18. And Williams, they do have points, four of them, in 10th place. But if you look at the driver's standings, it was just an amazing turnaround. So all of a sudden, Lewis went from 8 points behind to 17 points ahead of Sebastian Vettel. Now 188 points versus 171. And 131 points to Kimi Raikkonen, who is third in the championship. 122, Valtteri Bottas in fourth. And Daniel Ricciardo is fifth with 106. 0 points added this time around. We don't need to go all the way down of the drivers, but yeah, it was a transformative race in championship for driver and constructor, and for just luck and fate and destiny and all that kind of fun stuff. It was pretty nuts.
It was, and you know, it's going to be pretty hard to predict this weekend's results in Hungary. I mean, I expect Red Bull to be competitive. They may even pinch a win. Yeah, you have to fancy Ferrari. Lewis and Mercedes struggled a lot last season at Hungary. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to go into the summer break to see who actually has the advantage. And it's all to play for, no doubt about that.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's all there is to say about Formula One. However, I am not done talking, because there was an IndyCar race that, Chris, I have no doubt that you missed.
Missed it completely.
It was the IndyCar race in Toronto. It was fantastic. Okay. There was also mixed weather conditions throughout the weekend. It was a brilliant street race, and it was Scott Dixon that ended up winning the race. I'm telling you, just from pure racecraft and, you know, the mix of speed and strategy and everything that's going on, I'm going to convert you. You have to check out IndyCar. Nico Rosberg does not race IndyCar. You don't have to worry about that. There are a few Brits to cheer for. Max Chilton being one of them. What's that?
Was there any genuine overtaking?
Oh, plenty. Of course. Up and down the grid. Absolutely.
Okay. Chilton's not very quick there in IndyCar, is he?
Well, you know, Chilton's an interesting figure. I actually had a chance to interview him recently, and that'll be out soon enough in Auto Week. He's an interesting character, but he's also not the only Brit running. You'll forgive me for not remembering names. Oh God, no, Jordan King. He's another young Briton that's making his name in IndyCar. But my point is there's plenty international. There's plenty of people to cheer for. Mm-hmm. And the racecraft is brilliant. It's worth checking out. So I'm going to continually preach to you publicly until you one day actually do watch an IndyCar race. And hopefully you'll accept one of my invitations to watch it with me so that I can preach during the race.
That sounds enough to join, that does. Can I drink heavily throughout the race?
Yes. I'm telling you, it's worth it. But anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that, because I have some trivia.
Oh, is Dixon leading the championship? Who's winning the championship now?
Well, this is not the trivia, but yes, Scott Dixon is leading the championship.
Oh, there you go. It was predictable then, because he's the best driver in the series.
Geez, oh, God. That's it. Good heavens. All right. So we found the inner Kiwi in Chris Roche, but it is still time for trivia.
Oh, Scott's a legend, isn't he? You got to admit that.
Oh, Scott. I mean, I've interviewed him a couple times. He's well-spoken. He's desperately quick. He's got a lot of interesting things to say, and I'm sure he would have been successful in Formula One had he had a chance to pursue that, but he's just ended up having a wonderful long career in IndyCar, and I don't think anyone would fault him for it.
No, I mean, how many seasons has he done now? It's got to be, what, 15 seasons?
Pretty sure his first season, it was Champ Car, or CART, and it was like 2001, maybe 2002. So, he's
16, 17,
he's comfortably over 15 anyway. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Wait.
So there's not going to be a new question, but I'm going to ask the question again that I asked last podcast, and then you can guess, and then I will go ahead and give the answer right away.
Oh, good.
And then I will do the same for the British Grand Prix. So the question and answer, our listeners have already heard this one for their first, but you haven't. And then the British Grand Prix, that one will be new to everyone, and I will give that answer as well. So the first question was, even though we've had like what seems like a season's worth of racing already, there's still 12 Grand Prix to go in 2018. Now, okay, that's no longer true because this question's a little old. When was the last year that the entire F1 season was 12 Grand Prix long?
Ooh. Yeah, you have to go back away, don't you? I'm going to say
3. I like this. This is a confidence boost that you're struggling. Like I asked a decent question.
Yeah. Well, it's been creeping up for a long time, hasn't it? It's been creeping up. So I'm going to have to, start off. You could give me
the trend line.
I'm going to say 80s.
Races is pretty clear.
Yeah.
Right?
So I'm going to say something back in the 80s. If I got the right decade.
No.
Oh, okay. Good. Right. Well, just tell me. Else.
Yeah. We were already over 15 races by the 80s.
Okay.
Maybe 14 in 1980, but it was 1972, the 1972 season. And this is what I found interesting about this. That was, in fact, the only year that the race, the championship, was 12 rounds long. And it was Emerson Fittipaldi that won that championship. It was his first championship win. He also won in 74, if I remember correctly. That year, Formula One went to 4 continents. They raced in Argentina, South Africa, Spain, Monaco, Belgium, France, Great Britain, Germany, Austria, Italy, Canada, and the United States.
So do you happen to know if all the races even counted for the championship? Because for a long period of time, they only counted your so many best results, didn't they?
Yeah, I thought that largely died by the 60s. I know they did that in the 50s for sure, but I thought that was dead by the end of the 60s.
Well, no, you still had it during the Prost-Senna battles, remember? One of the championships between those guys, I can't remember if it was 88 or 89, was settled that way.
Oh no! Senna. Gosh, no! I didn't know. I guess.
Yeah. It wasn't just a straight count of points and wins. It was your best so many results.
Yes. No, I don't know. I don't know how many out of how many it was in 1972. That's a good follow up, though.
Okay, good.
Maybe that'll be a future trivia question.
All right.
So the question that I asked last podcast was, between 1964, and there's a better chance you'll know this one, between 1964 and 1986, the British Grand Prix was held at Brands Hatch during the even years and Silverstone during the odd years. In the 22 years and 11 Grand Prix held at the near London Brands Hatch, one driver won the race 3 times. Who was it, and when did he win? And I'll give you a hint, based on my research at least. He was the only driver that won the race more than once.
I am going to go with Jim Clark.
Ah, okay. You're going to like this one. It was Niki Lauda.
Oh, wow.
Who won it in 1976 in a Ferrari, 1982 and 1984 in a McLaren.
Okay.
And this was a fun fact. Incidentally, British drivers won the inaugural and final events. Jim Clark won the inaugural event, and Nigel Mansell won the final event in 1986.
And I have actually raced at both tracks, just for information.
Well, in a Formula One car.
Not quite an MG, okay. but the France Grand Prix track is, it's really weird, that circuit, because the Indy Bowl, you know, is a fascinating little track with a lot of undulations, no straights at all. And it just keeps turning and turning. And it's a great little circuit to race on. But then the GP track obviously takes the Indy Bowl in, but then it's just flat and featureless with long straights. There's such a contrast. And where was the first ever F1 race held? Do you know that?
The first ever F1 race? Yeah. Like the 1950 inaugural?
Yeah.
Wasn't that Silverstone?
It was Silverstone. There you go. Yeah. You paid attention during the British Grand Prix because they always trot that fact out.
Yeah, well, but the way you said it made it sound like a bit of a trick question. I'm like, well, gosh, I thought it was Silverstone. But, anyway, by the way, I had to look it up. I figured out what an anorak was, and that is firmly a Britishism, but it's a lovely one.
Yeah, you don't have the equivalent with poncho, do you?
No, you definitely do not. You definitely do not. But I'm surprised you don't... dig into your German roots more with your craft work. Anyway.
You're taking me aback with that one.
The upcoming race schedule, we have the 12th round of the Formula One Championship will be in Hungary on the 29th of July, and the 13th round of IndyCar will be at Mid-Ohio, also on July 29th. The World Endurance Championship, we're still waiting on the third round. That's going to come the 19th of August at Silverstone. And the 9th round of the IMSA Sports Car Series will be at Road America, a wonderful racetrack. And that will be the 5th of August, and that's a 240-minute event. Anyway, thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcast. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars and check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, it's been a blast. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye. Okay. Well, I was a bit slap happy because of the late hour, but we pulled it off.